Film Spotting is presented by Spout.com. This week, Oscar contenders are testing their mettle at the New York Film Festival. Get ringside coverage of the heavy-hitting new movies at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week on the show, two wars, two war movies, sort of. We'll review Spike Lee's Miracle at St. Anna and The Lucky One, starring Tim Robbins, Rachel McAdams, and Michael Pena.
We'll also share Adam's conversation with the co-writer and director of The Lucky Ones, Neil Berger. And we're also going to reveal our top five Spike Lee scenes.
But first, we go over there with the Buffalo Soldiers of the 92nd Infantry Division.
Americani.
We are Italians.
You got a boy that needs help. I don't know how the hell we got past German lines, but we're surrounded.
You ain't got to be scared. Feel that magic. All you got to do is believe in it.
Adam, you and I think, are on record as avowed Spike Lee enthusiasts.
Mm-hmm.
The 51-year-old director, born in Atlanta, raised in his beloved Brooklyn, has been a prolific and controversial figure on the cinematic scene since his first full-length film, She's Gotta Have It, released in 1986. Known for his indelible trademarks, you can be quick to identify a Spike Lee film. Like Martin Scorsese, Mr. Lee's films are usually set in New York. They feature a regular ensemble of actors, and they usually offer an exacting examination of race relations in this country, specifically the black experience in America. Now, most recently, Mr. Lee found his greatest box office success with 2006's Inside Man, a bank heist thriller, and arguably, if you overlook the many, many successful television commercial campaigns that Mr. Lee has directed, Inside Man was Spike's most commercial and most mainstream effort. Now, make no mistake about it, his latest film, Miracle at St. Anna, finds the director working within what could be described as another genre film, this time a war film. The film opens in 1980s New York, and initially, it certainly feels like a Spike Lee movie. There's one of his regular actors, John Turturro, investigating a seemingly random shooting of a white man by a black post office employee in plain daylight. But we are quickly swept away to World War II Italy and the front lines, alongside the segregated 92nd Infantry. Actors were not familiar seeing in Spike Lee films. And then there's this element of magical realism I don't believe I've ever encountered in a Spike Lee joint. And that's my question for you, Adam. Working within a genre, can Mr. Lee speak just as powerfully as he does in Do the Right Thing in Malcolm X? Or do we need to create a subgenre within his filmography, demarcating a Spike Lee joint from a Spike Lee film? And which one is Miracle at St. Anna?
Wow. I don't know that I'm actually equipped to answer this question. Maybe some of our very intelligent listeners out there can weigh in, as I'm sure they will. But I don't really want to pass judgment on him just based on this film. Maybe he can handle magical realism. If I am just going off of this film, though, I much prefer Spike Lee joints. Unfortunately, that's just me. I do think he speaks much more powerfully in those films, and I do think in this film he maybe labors too hard to infuse messages in the movie and to make those powerful statements in what is a war film, what is a genre film. He found a way to do it very well in Inside Man, to work within the heist genre and yet still work in all of those scenes about power, which is his big fixation, I think, in a lot of ways, and that's a big aspect of race, of course. He found the way to mix it there. He doesn't do it as well here, and I do want to give him credit, though, for what he is trying to do within the genre. He's trying to take these characters, these African-American soldiers, and give them their due on screen, put their stories on screen, because they haven't had it. We, of course, get early in this film our main character, the older main character, sitting in his apartment in the 80s watching The Longest Day, mm-hmm. the John Wayne movie. And of course, that's Spike you know, giving you that message that, hey, there aren't any black characters back in The Longest Day. And he's been railing against that with the recent Clint Eastwood movies. He's trying to right that wrong, and that's great. But what he does do well here is something that I wouldn't have thought to say if it wasn't for one of our listeners, actually, Kamaria, who we know. We saw her at the screening of Miracle at St. Anne's. She was one of the listeners here in Chicago who helped out with our recent film spotting meetup. And she sent an email to me saying that the biggest reason she likes Spike Lee is because, and this is her quote, "I especially thought this after St. Anna, he shows us what no one else has the guts to. I've never seen a war movie where the black characters are subjects with different agendas and beliefs and not objects to prove a point or means to a white character's enlightenment." See movies like Glory or Blood Diamond, movies she does like as well. I think she's exactly right there. What's really refreshing about this movie is, like I said, seeing the story of these black soldiers on screen since they have been overlooked, and they aren't there to enlighten a white character. Even more than that, what I like is that they aren't all of one mind. She's right. They aren't all just speaking for the black race. These are all individuals, and we actually see some of the characters. Stamps, played by Derek Luke, and Bishop, played very well by Michael Ealy.
Michael Ealy, he's the best part of this.
Yeah, he really is. They come to pretty much hate each other and what the other guy stands for, so I really do think that's great. For me, though, Maddie, what I was disappointed about with the movie is how they were, it seemed to me anyway, still pretty much the same old war movie cliche soldiers.
Yes.
They were just black instead of white.
You're absolutely right. It's almost as though you saw my notes before I came in here.
I did not.
You didn't?
No.
Look, there's a trend recently in war films towards presenting sort of really gritty battlefield realism. Think the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, the great HBO television series Band of Brothers, or Clint Eastwood's Letters from Iwo Jima.
Sure.
Those films are a stark departure from the romanticized epics of the war films from the 50s and 60s, The Longest Day, as you mentioned, The Green Berets, The Dirty Dozen, all of which, you know, usually feature a platoon of all-American, white guys, you know, saving the world for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Spike Lee lets you know very early on what this film is going to be, what type of war film he is making. This is his answer to John Wayne and The Longest Day. And we know because we see one of the characters very early on under, you know, watching his television, watching The Longest Day, under a poster of Joe Louis, of course, a propaganda poster exhorting people to join the war effort. In a nutshell, this film is much closer in tone to the last 2 hours of Saving Private
Ryan
than it is to the first 20 minutes. This film falls victim to the very flaws that genre had.
Yeah.
People talk in really expository, heightened dialogue. Characters pair off into room after room for a good 5 minutes so one of them can explain exactly what they're doing, who they are, what their point is in this movie. And you've got, of course, the German Hauptstufenführer. He's fat. He's ruthless to the point of being comical. You've got the partisan Italian fighter hiding out in the woods. Of course, he's dashingly handsome.
Uh-huh.
And I accept those. I accept this proposal. I accept those are all sort of deliberate cliches. What Spike is saying is saying, hey, this is our romanticized movie. This is going to have all the same flaws that all those films from the 50s and 60s had.
Mm-hmm.
But what I take umbrage with is the point that you hit on is that the four main characters of this film never rise above the cliche. I really felt that these four men at the center of this sweeping adventure never sort of rise above the outlines that existed on paper in the treatment for this film.
Right.
You've got the friendly, slow mountain of a man.
That's it.
You've got the womanizer. You've got the proud staff sergeant. And then you've got the Puerto Rican from New York, who I actually felt I didn't know anything about throughout
this
entire film.
He's the main character of the film, and we never see him.
I need to know these men better. I need to know who they represent, what's their specific struggle, what's their background, and it's precisely because we don't have a cinematic prototype for these men that I can easily draw from in cinema history that I need more information about them beyond the obligatory scene where one soldier rails against a fellow soldier's patriotism, asking, "What has this army done for us? They're using us." And I just get scene after scene of that. I needed more. I needed to know who these four men are.
Yeah, I basically have the exact same descriptions of those characters in my notes, just with slightly different words. And it did occur to me that maybe that was Spike Lee's point. He's sort of reclaiming the cinematic cliche and saying, hey, we belong too. We have the same stereotypes on our side
as you do. So we can call one soldier Tex. We can call one soldier Brooklyn. I get that.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, with the material that he has here, it doesn't make the movie that interesting. interesting.
No.
It just leaves it more wanting for me.
No, it doesn't. And I don't know if we're supposed to give him credit or actually be critical of Spike Lee, that he can actually take a Nazi commander, not the one you spoke of, but the one just underneath him, and actually give him more humanity than the white commanding officer.
Oh.
I mean,
well,
it's really unbelievable.
And unfortunately, those white commanding officers are just basically Simon Legree caricatures.
Yeah.
And I think, why are you even raising that?
I know.
Why
Walter Goggins as Noakes. Oh, I mean, really, I felt
awful.
So bad for
awful.
Him.
Awful. The fact of the matter is that you're concentrating on the black experience in World War II, something that no film really has ever done. That's enough. We're going to bring our own questions to that situation. You don't need to give us the vaudeville evil caricatures that he runs out here.
No, he didn't. And you hit on this. My big problem with the film actually is that I think the screenwriter, James McBride, who also wrote the book that the movie's based on, and Spike Lee, I think they got bogged down in pedagogy. I mean, there are too many conversations here where characters are clearly just spouting rhetoric. And it's interesting, impassioned stuff. And it's true, but it all rings false. These are soldiers. They're in a bad situation behind enemy lines in Italy. They're focused on staying alive and trying to get back to their side in one piece. And they take these little timeouts to actually discuss racism. And, you know, I think this is something you've said before here on the show, Maddie, that theme can't be at the forefront dramatically. You can't talk about theme. It just has to come out of the dialogue, out of the characters and the story. And sometimes here it definitely does. But other times I was watching guys like Derek Luke, who I think is good here as Stamps, and thinking, man, how did he choke down that dialogue scene where he has to know he's just preaching and probably not saying something his character in that situation would say? There's too much tell here going on, not enough show.
Well, right, exactly. And basically, as I said, the people sort of pair off with other people. And the only reason the other person
dramatically,
in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah, so is that they can lob a softball up and say, how do you feel?
Right.
Why are you doing this? Well, it's because I'm a fascist. Because I'm no longer a fascist. I don't believe this in X and then Y and then Z. And it just gets so frustrating because it's absolutely so dull. Don't talk at us. Show us what's going on.
That's it. And because of that, the movie ends up being very slow. It's a long film. And again, I have nothing wrong with long films if they're compelling. This one is all over the place and it does meander. And there are 6 different storylines at least that do mostly converge, but not in a satisfying way. We follow the Italian character. We follow the Nazi character. You've got the Joe Levitt sequence, the bookend, where you've got Joseph Gordon-Levitt as this reporter. If you watch how it plays out, I swear at least 20 minutes had to be left on the cutting room floor where they decided, we don't actually want to get into this. The movie's long enough. And so he's got this scene at the beginning and the scene at the end. And it just doesn't work. I have to say, unfortunately, because we are Spike Lee fans, I never got my bearings with this movie. There are some powerful moments. There are some touching moments with the young boy, Angelo, who really ends up driving the story forward. Those are great scenes. I don't want to sound like there aren't some fantastic scenes here in this film, but on the whole, it's all over the place.
No, you're absolutely right. And you're right. The most intriguing element of this film was that magical realism, or the possibility of magical realism, of this little Italian boy adopted by the company who holds conversations with an imaginary friend, Arturo. It sort of reminded me of the same ground covered by Pan's Labyrinth in 2006, you know, director Guillermo del Toro. But structurally, Lee here, he's setting up two parallels. You've got the storyline of the men trapped in the remote Italian village, and then you have this other storyline which is corresponding with an actual World War II event.
Right.
And unfortunately, Lee is never able to mesh the two storylines together. They're strung along really clunkily.
They are.
And in the final third of the film, when we're treated to what's supposed to be shocking reveal after shocking reveal, it never really packs a punch at all. The boy is the secret. He is the bomb under the table. We should be asking every frame, what does he know? What's going to happen? How is it going to affect these men? And unfortunately, he disappears for stretches at a time, and he gets diffused. His power gets diffused by all these endless scenes. I mean, at the one point, the Italian partisan woman is saying, first it was going to be the British that were going to liberate us.
Yeah.
Then it was going to be the French. Now it's going to be you Americans. You really took 45 seconds to give that little sort of tidbit, that little sort of historical tidbit.
Right.
It just came across so clunkily. I'm thinking, Come on, Spike, you can tie this together better.
Yeah, he can, as we're going to find out when we get into the last segment of the show, our top five Spike Lee scenes. Because, let's face it, showing and not telling is something he actually does very well, and packing a punch is something he also does very well. Unfortunately, it's not on display here. And when we go into the break, Maddie, maybe you can explain to me what John Leguizamo is doing in this film for 7 or 8 minutes. I still have not figured out exactly why he's in this movie at all.
Don't look at me.
No,
don't
Miracle look at me. St. Anna is out now in theaters everywhere. If you can solve the Leguizamo mystery, please let us know. Send us an email if you agree or disagree with our takes at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
Okay, when we come back, Film Spotting asks, do you feel lucky, punks? We'll play Massacre Theater and review the new film starring my favorite actor, Tim Robbins. I did not write that.
No, you didn't.
Stay with us.
Not a moment too soon. I finally know what it's like to be alive. I finally know what it's like to be alive. Just like every teen movie an overplayed song can proclaim. Just like 365 consecutive sunny days. Just like 3 years later, not a moment too soon. Discovering you.
Hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Couldn't tell which legs with which arms with which, and it was a terrible mess. I tell you, I almost threw up myself. I just like your name and address, that's all.
Why?
Well, like I said, it's such a mess down there afterwards, and makes identification impossible. Even if they find your driver's license, all that blood and everything.
I think I'm gonna puke.
Oh, don't do that, son.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It is time now for Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I perform a scene from a beloved screenplay, and you, our ever-beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a free, beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, the scene we did not massacre...
No?
...was not from Lethal Weapon.
It was not.
It was not from The Negotiator. Instead, it was from Dirty Harry, a scene between Clint Eastwood and Bill Couch, a tie-in, of course, with the Cops Gone Wild week on our show last week.
Yeah, we did have that theme last week, and it was the most wrongly entered Massacre Theater ever. A lot of people thinking maybe The Negotiator, but I actually did know the Lethal Weapon entries were coming. I don't know if you know that film as well as I do, Maddie, but one of my favorite scenes in the movie is the suicide scene where Mel Gibson goes down to talk down a jumper, and it has one of my favorite lines in the film where he says, "Hey, I'm a cop," and the guy says, "Yeah, a psycho nut cop." We used to actually say that in junior high, so I don't know. Maybe we were crazy.
All right, well, why don't you reach into that Film Spotting hat and pull out this week's winner.
And the winner is Michael Fussell from Charleston, South Carolina.
I have always wanted to get down to Charleston, South Carolina. I'm a Civil War nut. I've always wanted to see Fort Sumter.
Well, maybe Michael will let you stay on his couch when you make it down there. Congratulations to Michael. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and Maddie, I don't think we need to give any hints about how this may tie in with what we are discussing on this week's show. So let's go ahead and dive into the scene. I started off, you're going to give me the action.
And action.
Morning, Colonel. Change your mind about that bottle?
I want 600 pairs of shoes and 1,200 pairs of socks and anything else you've been holding out on us, you piece of rat filth.
I don't have any.
Yeah, not for blank, you don't.
Not for anybody.
I see. All right, I'll just look around to see if you haven't misplaced them.
Hey!
You son of a bitch!
God damn it, you can't!
Can I? I'm a colonel, you nasty little cuss. You think you can keep 700 soldiers without proper shoes because you think it's funny? Now, where would that power come from?
And scene. All right. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title. And after your last line, Maddie, I think it's probably pretty obvious. Send it to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, October 1st.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
We go down in the water? You're gonna be sitting pretty.
Don't talk about planes crashing when you're on a plane.
Why not? You got leave?
Yeah, 30 days.
Me too. How long have you got?
The rest of my life, thank you very much. I get to Vegas, I kept you sitting around here.
You're going to Vegas?
Yeah.
I'm going to Vegas.
Well, it's nice meeting y'all. I'm gonna rent a car before there's none left.
That's it. Sorry. No cars left.
You guys in the Army?
That's a clip from the trailer for the new film from writer-director Neil Berger, The Lucky Ones. And as you heard from it, the plot is pretty simple. Three soldiers on leave from Iraq, TK, Coley, and Cheever. Cheever, played by Tim Robbins, is actually home for good. Their paths unexpectedly cross and stay crossed as they road trip across the country, all with their own agendas. And Maddie, I'm especially curious about your reaction to this movie, since neither of us have really liked the majority of Iraq war theme movies that have come out and we've discussed on the show. And I do want to emphasize here that this is an Iraq war themed movie, since probably 5 minutes of it actually takes place in Iraq. But The Lucky Ones also has two other potential strikes against it. It was co-written and directed by Berger, as I said, whose last movie, The Illusionist, was not one you particularly cared for. And you, like your predecessor in that chair across from me, have a strong dislike for Tim Robbins, actor. Here, we're stuck in a minivan with Mr. Robbins for most of the movie. Were you lucky enough to avoid these pitfalls and actually enjoy the film?
Well, first, Mr. Senator, I will address the Tim Robbins comment until a little bit later.
Okay.
I actually think this is a very nice companion piece to Miracle at St. Anna.
Yeah.
I think melodrama has opened the door and pulled up a chair here in the studio, sipping out of one of our film spotting mugs to oversee the show this week. You know what? This film reminded me of an 80s movie. Oddly enough, I mean, all it needed was sort of a synthesized Tangerine Dream or Herbie Hancock score. I think if you were to brainstorm in an attempt to list every single bad thing that could happen, apocryphal or otherwise,
sure,
to a returning soldier from Iraq, and make no mistake, this film is specific to this very war. This film includes every situation that you could think of. Scene after scene, it is calamity after calamity, mm-hmm, all presented in a sort of a lighthearted, rather soap operatic fashion. And about the time the natural disaster shows up is when I started to drift away.
I know
where
you're going.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
But. There's a big but here. All in all, I enjoyed myself with this film. And the reason is, as always, what's going to save the day?
Acting.
Acting.
Yeah.
The performances here really, really made this film work for me. Rachel McAdams is brilliantly earnest and cheerful. Tim Robbins, I cannot stand him when he's playing straight
characters. But here he's kind of dumb.
You're exactly. See, he plays dumb really well.
Yeah.
Cadillac Man, Bull Durham, he's great in those films. But he's got this really nice, sad stoicism about him. But it's Michael Peña that steals the show from him. He is a rock. In every single film that I've seen him in, he never tries to do too much with this role. He solidly plays everything asked of him. And I think a lesser actor could play hysterical with the tribulations he has to endure, some of which are just mind-numbingly dumb, I have to say, just inane. But he doesn't. I mean, he is a soldier through and through. And I just wrapped our review of Miracle of St. Anna saying, my biggest complaint was I didn't know who the characters were.
Yeah.
I know exactly who these men and women are here in The Lucky Ones. And it's the truth found in those performances that really, I have to say, delivered this movie for me.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I can actually accuse you maybe this time of stealing my notes, because, again, we're on exactly the same page with this movie. I was watching this film thinking, you know, one crazy thing after another is happening to this trio. It actually culminates in a scene where two characters accidentally drive into the middle of a tornado.
Yes.
And to Neil Berger's credit, I suppose, it's not just there for spectacle. It's actually there to bring these characters closer together, literally.
It can't be there for spectacle because it looks like a tornado generated like circa 1983 yeah. Tron graphics.
I know. Unfortunately, it isn't good. But it is actually there to move the story forward, even though you have to think to yourself, surely Neil Berger could have found a better, more reasonable excuse for these two people to end up near each other than a tornado. But that's what we get. And, you know, the people they meet along the way as they're traveling across America are pretty much standard road movie fare. But even so, I'm with you. I like the movie. And you'll hear me ask Neil Berger in the next segment about a few of these reasons why I did like it. I thought it was the perfect response to Stop Loss, a movie we reviewed a little while back.
Good
and
call.
Even some of the other Iraq War films we discussed during that review, In the Valley of Ella, Redacted, they labor so hard to show the horror of war that they, I think inadvertently, certainly in some cases, they end up reducing these soldiers to monsters. They're completely incapable of assimilating back into society. And I don't want to downplay the struggle. Soldiers genuinely have assimilating back into society. I think it's actually these movies that do them a disservice. And here with the lucky ones, you have three people. They're dealing more with the baggage dropped on them when they return home than the baggage from the war. We don't get any big nightmare sequences or freak out scenes or scenes where, you know, they're sleeping in foxholes they've dug in their front yards. The most we get is Michael Pena as TK waking up from a bad dream that we don't see any of. He just wakes up, they get it, they recognize that he woke up from a bad dream, and everyone goes back to sleep. It's great. And, you know, early scores on Metacritic, I did glance before we came in to discuss this movie. There's only a few up there, but I'm kind of alone here. We're kind of alone here. The best score was from Ebert. Everyone else is ripping on this film, and Ebert actually only gave it 3 stars, which is what I'm giving it. And he says that what makes The Lucky Ones so gratifying is anything but gravitas. These three characters are simply likable, warm, sincere, and often funny. And as Mr. Ebert often does, he gets it dead on. That's it. I like these characters. I like the performances. And I like that it wasn't about gravitas. Miracle of St. Anna is all gravitas. Most war movies are all about gravitas. And maybe they should be, but it's nice to see one that isn't. It's nice to have a movie that can have a sense of humor and that isn't preachy and that doesn't get bogged down in politics and ideology. And this movie doesn't make that mistake.
At the end of the day, it's a parable. It really is. I mean, yes, it's hokey. I mean, it is towing that line of crossing over into the sort of that after school special zone of sentiment, but it never goes over the edge because the actors keep pulling it off from the edge. What it left me was sort of a very odd viewing experience because I really didn't believe most of what was happening to these characters, but I was curious to see how the actors would pull it off, and they did it. They did it every single time. And I, you know, I know that doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement of the film, but I have to say, I had a smile on my face throughout this film, and I was consistently entertained. And at the end of the day, that's all I want. Don't talk down to me. You can put melodrama forward, and if you do it with tight direction and great performances, I will go along for the ride.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I, too, had a smile on my face, and I was entertained by it, and you are also dead on about Michael Pena. He, of course, made my top five list last week, actor pairings I most wanted to see. I put him with Gael Garcia Bernal, another actor I really like, and it was because of this film, because I had just recently seen The Lucky Ones. Here, he really does stand out. He's playing a character in TK I really hadn't seen before, someone who realizes he isn't going to get anything handed to him, so he does work harder than everybody else, but instead of being humble about it, he's actually arrogant and confrontational. He knows he works harder and that he's better than most people because of it, and yet he's got charisma. He's funny. He's likable. You can tell even in the brief scenes we get back in Iraq that the other soldiers like him and respect him, and I did too. I thought he was just brilliant here. I think he's one of those actors that can do pretty much anything. So he really did stand out for me with this movie. And we're going to hear more about The Lucky Ones here in a moment. It's out now in limited release. You see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, time for a quick break. Up next, The Lucky Ones director Neil Berger sits down with Adam to defend his auteurist street cred. Adam, stay with us.
Falling out after falling out, don't count me out for sitting it out for a few. 'Cause I am the letdown. Well, I'm not ready, I think.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Bice from Spout.com. I co-host Film Couch, Spout's weekly podcast. This week on Spout Blog, we've got complete coverage of Fantastic Fest, Austin's killer genre film event. Our coverage includes an interview with Kevin Smith, whose new film Zack and Miri Make a Porno opened the festival, and reviews, including the much-anticipated Swedish vampire film Let the Right One In, Cargo 200, a dark Russian masterpiece, and I Think We're Alone Now, a documentary about adults with an unhealthy obsession with 80s pop star Tiffany, and much, much more. Also on the blog, check out an interview with Chuck Palahniuk, author of Fight Club and Choke. We also talked to Karina about Fantastic Fest, gore, barbecue, and karaoke.
So I'll let you know when I'm ready to go and get serious and grow up. But for now, I'm just a lost boy, and I can't find my way home.
She loves all those Latin dances. Samba, merengue, tango.
She's a looker, huh?
She is.
Yeah.
What she's doing with someone like me, I'll never know it. I'm not going to ask.
We're lucky ones, aren't we? We made it through one piece. I got shot in the leg, but all I got to do is put some goo on it. So.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. I'm Maddie. He's Adam. Well, Adam, recently you got a chance to catch up with the co-writer and director of The Lucky Ones, Neil Berger. And we just got done reviewing the film, mm-hmm. So I want to know, how did those actors, what did they bring to the process? Because it certainly wasn't the script that really made this film.
No, probably not. And we do definitely get into that during this discussion. He has a lot of praise, as you might imagine, for his cast here. And, you know, Neil Berger is a guy who I respect from his previous films. I liked Interview with the Assassin. I liked The Illusionist. And here, I started by asking him how the idea for The Lucky Ones originated and what story he wanted to tell.
I did a movie called The Illusionist, and I'd been out of the country for some time. And so like anybody else coming back into the country, you get that culture shock on reentry. So that was part of it. And then the other part of it, obviously, is what's in the air politically and culturally. And I just had this idea that came to me about a couple of people taking a road trip across the country. And I wanted to take the snapshot of America now and kind of take the temperature of the country. And I thought, what better way to do that than, you know, to see it through the eyes of three people that have been out of the country for some time, and in particular, who were soldiers, you know, giving of themselves for that country.
Of course, very little of it takes place actually in Iraq, but this movie will get lumped into the category with a lot of other Iraq war-themed movies. Is that fair? Does it belong?
It's not really too fair, and it's something that we're really fighting. It has nothing, you know, it's not an Iraq movie. It's a movie about America now, and it's actually funny, and it's kind of an epic emotional journey about these three people really just looking for family, and they're really just trying to have a good time and trying to be normal driving across the country.
Well, it's interesting that you say trying to be normal, because one of the things I found really refreshing about the movie is that it didn't do something that a lot of these recent Iraq war-themed movies have done, I think, which is, in trying to show the horrible effects of war, I think they actually end up kind of trivializing things a little bit, because scenes, one after another, are just one big freak-out scene. And here you actually have characters who are disturbed, certainly, by what they've seen and are going through some rough times, but are reasonably well-adjusted. Was that your approach to this?
Yeah, I mean, they're Americans first and just people first, and they just happen to be soldiers. And that's the whole movie is much more about the country now and their particular journey. And, the war is just one aspect of this country, and it's just a small part of this movie, too. And they're just people trying to connect with other people.
I haven't really seen much of anything lately because I've been overseas the past 14 months, and, you know, I'm in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm home on leave for 30 days, so I'm hoping to catch up. I like your jacket.
It's okay.
What's the I stand for?
Indiana?
You know, the college and the state where you're standing right now. Yeah, you know, I was thinking of going to college when I get out, but do you like it?
Do you think you could be quiet?
And unlike some of those other war movies we were discussing, this movie has a sense of humor, which is something as well I found really refreshing about it.
Yeah, this movie is funny, and it's as well as being about something serious and sometimes heartbreaking, but it's really a laugh-out-loud movie at certain points, which is a funny thing in a way, but it walks a very fine line between absurdity and tragedy. But it seems like that laughter allows certain truths to land with more impact, and I think also laughter has an incredible ability to heal the human spirit. And I think it's very important in a movie like this and in a subject like this.
You've had a few public screenings now of this movie. How were crowds reacting? Were you getting the laughs you expected and maybe some you didn't expect?
Yeah, no, people laughed when they were supposed to. And what's interesting is that the laughter kind of opens up their emotions and they're not resisting. And the movie or the subjects in the movie, and then when there is something more poignant or whatever, they just are feeling that much more. And so the laughter is really, first of all, it's entertaining. The movie is entertaining, but it's also very effective.
Did you do much research on the film? Did you talk to soldiers who would come back and what their experiences were like?
I did, and my co-writer, Dirk Wittenborn, did as well. And we talked to soldiers, and then we also took this trip across the country before we wrote and met lots of people and saw lots of things, and you know, it all went into the story.
That's really interesting. So did that trip basically end up getting mimicked on screen, the one you took?
It did, for the most part, yeah. We took the road trip, and then we repeated it in production. We were this crazy traveling circus dragging, you know, 100 cast and crew across the country, which was like a huge undertaking.
Yeah.
And, you know, had some wild moments.
We're talking with Neil Berger, the director of the new film, The Lucky Ones, and you mentioned your co-writer here. And on your previous films, you had written it yourself, maybe adapted it in the case of The Illusionist, but you'd written it yourself. Here you're working with a co-writer. How did that process go?
Well, working with a co-writer was a really good thing on this, because it's this cross-country journey and because it's sort of this, you know, rambling story that has cultural and political overtones and a lot of different locations and a lot of different events that happen, which is inevitable on a road movie, traveling all the, you know, from New York all the way to Las Vegas. And it was just a lot to bite off, and Dirk is this wonderful writer and novelist, and he's got great stories, and so we put it all together and got it done.
Gosh. For what?
Can we just argue about golf, please?
There's a lot at stake over there, Peter.
Yeah, a lot of money.
Barbara, what's the name of that woman who's always trying to get that Saturday morning tea time?
Angela Morton.
Right. That's her big cause.
What do you really think we're fighting for? What are you doing over there?
Honestly, we're just trying to stay alive.
Stay alive?
I bet that's not too easy.
Stay alive, Jesus Christ. And if that's your attitude, no wonder we're losing.
Bob.
You have Tim Robbins here in a major role, one of the three main characters. And, of course, his politics are very well known. It's not something that actually fascinates me all that much, but I'm just curious, with a movie like this where he's playing a soldier, were you afraid of any sort of backlash or how people out in middle America would respond to Tim Robbins? A lot of people know what his politics are like, and here in this role, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, it did give me pause because, you know, Tim has been against the war. But on the other hand, Tim's, you know, a great patriot and really loves this country and has done, you know, reached out to soldiers. And so a lot of soldiers while we were shooting, people would come up to him and wanted to talk and tell him their stories. And he gave them, you know, his time always. And I think what Tim really liked was the character. And the character is a great character. I think he responded to that. And for me, he's such a good actor. You know, if you remember Bull Durham, mm-hmm. or, you know, The Shawshank Redemption, it's a return to those kind of roles for him. And he's just a really powerful and subtle actor. He's, you know, and very funny in it.
Well, along with him, you have Rachel McAdams. She's very good in the film. And Michael Pena, who has been good in many roles, including World Trade Center, but I think he really does shine here. Can you just talk about the casting process of these three individuals? Did you have any of them in mind from the get-go?
Well, I didn't write it with anybody in mind. That's not really the way I work. But when the time came to cast it, you know, Rachel was top of our list. She's such a great young actress. And when I met her, she has a lot of the qualities that Coley has. The character of Coley is this kind of naive and very optimistic young woman, but who's also a fighter. I mean, you get to see Rachel punch out some people in this movie. And Rachel herself has a wonderful openness and gentleness and kind of a small town background. Yet she's very driven and determined in her own way. And just, you know, she was the perfect fit for it. And she can really throw a punch.
And Michael Pena?
And Michael Pena has this kind of instinctive quality. He's really driven and wants to be the best at what he does.
Like his character.
And he's playing a guy, TK, who is just a know-it-all and very proud and really arrogant and happens to be very good at what he does, but wants to make sure everybody knows it as well.
I tell you, this woman's smart. She's got plans for it. Yeah, she's dying to get married because I'm going to take it to the top.
How are you her ticket to the top? She's a lieutenant. She outranks you.
No, right now she does. I mean, she's got the connections, but I got the juice. I mean, it's like a merger between us. You know? She's going to get me in the officer candidate school. I'm going to move up the ranks. And then I'm going to run for office. And you have to have a good head of hair to run for office, and I have a good head of hair.
Visually, The Illusionist was pretty elaborate, set in Vienna, and it's a period piece, turn of the century. And even on Interview with the Assassin, you're messing around with this kind of pseudo-documentary style. Here, you've got three characters for 90% of the film, or close, trapped in a minivan. Visually, did you feel stifled by that at all?
Well, it was a huge challenge to somehow make that interesting. And you're right, The Illusionist is this elaborate, stylized piece. And what I was going for here was something very different. I wanted to have almost a caught-on-the-run kind of feel, very loose and real. And because, you know, the movie's about, you know, characters based on real people going through this experience that's happening now. And so I wanted the filmmaking to have a realness or an authenticity to it.
Yeah. In Toronto, actually, where the film premiered, I was talking with one of my colleagues here, a local Chicago film critic, and I mentioned that I was doing this interview, and he said that he didn't know what to make of you. He's kind of an auteurist. He's a guy that's looking for a way to put directors in a nice little box.
Right.
And looking at your film so far, he hasn't been able to do that. And so he was kind of joking, of course. But what do you make of that? What's your response to that?
These last three movies, Interview with the Assassin and The Illusionist and The Lucky Ones, they're incredibly different. Though I suppose The Lucky Ones is a little bit close to Interview with the Assassin, has a road movie aspect to it. But what they have in common is kind of a thematic thing. They're all concerned with various levels of truth. The, you know, truth of the Kennedy assassination, what really happened, versus conspiracy theories, which are sort of substitutes for truth. And then in The Illusionist, truth versus, you know, magic or illusion or faith. And then here, it's really truth versus, you know, self-deception.
Mm-hmm.
The characters kind of operating under, you know, these sort of delusions. And then outright lies as well.
Yeah, deception was really my answer to that, too. The more I thought about it, that there is that thread throughout all these films, characters in The Lucky Ones kind of living a lie or hoping for something, and then we learn a little bit more about them and get some truth into that. And even formally with the movies, there's that element to it, I think, a little bit, where you like to mix genres, it seems, right? We have a road movie here, but we have kind of the war movie. The Illusionist is this period piece, but it's a love story. And then mixing the documentary and the thriller aspects there, they kind of work with that whole idea of a split personality almost.
Yeah, and I think each of the movies are kind of great movie-going experiences too. And each of them have sort of a puzzle that's put together. And certainly in The Illusionist, and in a more subtle way here, the characters go through this transformation and it has a very improvisational look to it, but it's all very scripted, tightly scripted, and because, you know, what they say in the beginning pays off in the end, and it's, you know, what happens to them is like a little jigsaw puzzle.
It's funny, a couple of years ago on the show, after The Illusionist came out on my show, we did our top five directors of the future, directors who had made fewer than three movies that we thought really had promising careers. I actually had you as my number one pick. I love The Illusionist so much. How did you celebrate that? I'm sure it made its way out to the Burger household.
I'm celebrating it every day, and just getting to make another movie is a celebration of that. So.
And that's exactly where I wanted to go. What do you have in mind next?
I'm in pre-production on a movie called The Dark Fields for Universal, and that's a very different movie again. It's kind of a thriller that takes place in New York about a pill that makes you smarter, and but in a way, not in any sort of sci-fi way, but in the sense that steroids is, you know, performance enhancing. This is, why wouldn't there be something? In fact, there is, you know, to make your synapses fire quicker so you can think smarter and faster. And then I have another movie after that called The Criminals, also in New York.
And are these films that you wrote by yourself or adapted or co-wrote?
Dark Fields, I'm just directing. Somebody else wrote that. And then The Criminals, I actually wrote with Dirk Wittenborn, who wrote The Lucky Ones with me.
So there's a potential partnership there.
There is. We're great partners in crime at the moment. So,
well, I look forward to those. And best of luck with this film. I really did enjoy it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Again, that was my conversation with Neil Berger, whose previous film, The Illusionist, as I said in the interview there, Maddie, I'm one of the few people that will defend. I think that movie got wrongfully lumped in with The Prestige, and people said, hey, it's a better film. Maybe it is a better film, but it's still a good one.
No, my problem with The Illusionist, and I have to say, on the whole, I did sort of enjoy it as sort of this sadistic fairy tale that he's telling. But it's so different to look at the lucky ones and the way the actors are so reined in here and so on par with everything. You look at The Illusionist, you've got Ed Norton doing one thing and you've got Paul Giamatti doing something completely different. It's almost so they're two different projects directed by two different directors.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I did not, as you heard there, ask him your question about did he control his actors this time. I didn't pose that one to Mr. Berger, Maddie.
Good for you. Very good. All right, well, time for another quick break. Up next, Adam and I do the right thing by bringing you our top five Spike Lee scenes, and that's the double truth, Ruth. Stay with us.
So predictable, I thought. Just like the sun rising every day. And you're always there, I thought. Just like the air and all that. But sometimes you feel like you're in hiding. Just like the sun coming up behind the clouds. And sometimes you act so invisible. Just like the air and all that. Well, don't worry, dear.
You can go to sleep.
It's no better year.
You can count on me.
Don't worry, dear.
You can go to sleep.
It's no better year.
You can count on me.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD. And Maddie, coming out this Tuesday, it's a very good week for new DVDs. We can recommend all four of these films. Maybe you had some reservations about Iron Man, but we can definitely recommend these movies. Iron Man, the big summer hit, is out now. A commentary by Jon Favreau, the director, is on it. It's got a 7-part documentary on the movie and a whole lot more. So if you were a fan of Iron Man, that is out now. And Bigger, Stronger, Faster. Maddie, did this one actually end up creeping onto your top 5 list?
I think it was my number
close?
My number five.
I think, and it was definitely an honorable mention for me, the documentary that really digs in to the whole steroids controversy and sheds a lot of light on it. It really is worth checking out. Also worth checking out, for sure, Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Love this film.
Yeah, we really like that film, and the performances by Jason Segel, Mila Kunis are great in it. And then for something completely different, after you've gotten excited and had a lot of fun with Sarah Marshall, you can then go watch Taxi to the Dark Side from Alex Gibney. It's the one that won Best Documentary at the last Oscars. It includes a director's commentary from the director, Alex Gibney, and also deleted scenes. So all four of those movies coming out this Tuesday. Maddie, before we get into donations, do we want to take a moment at all to acknowledge all the people who wrote in thinking they were very clever, pointing out how we said Robert
Our
Frost
listeners are so
instead
smart.
Of David
they
Frost?
They are so smart.
I know.
We're so happy every time that we get one of these corrections.
Yes, we
because
are.
We know that there are about 20 more coming.
Exactly.
But the fact of the matter is, it was not our fault.
It really was not our fault. I'm not going to throw the listener under the bus because he's a great listener, great emailer, but we were just reading his email. He made the mistake and said, Robert Frost, we're busy during a show. Our minds are in a lot of places just trying to get this show done. We did not think about the fact that it was
really
dated.
I have talked to our intern. It has been dealt with.
It won't happen again.
Although, you know, to be fair, I would love to see a film with Nixon and Robert Frost.
I mean, who wouldn't want to see that movie? Maybe it would be a better film. But nevertheless, we are looking forward to Frost Nixon with David Frost, of course, in that film.
All right, it is time now for donations, and we want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, every week we are just truly humbled and flabbergasted by each and every single donation that we get. You guys, your support goes such a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. So thank you. We had, I believe this week, 5 Silver Club donors. Let's start with Bridget from Caledon, Ontario, Canada, one of our favorite provinces. Lynn from Paris, France. Yes. Have we ever gotten a donation from Paris before?
I don't think we have, actually, Maddie, at least not in a while.
And Christopher from Brooklyn, New York. I mean, seriously, that is probably the biggest borough.
Everybody there listens to Film Spotting.
We are huge there. They have Film Spotting nights on Saturday.
They do.
Dwight from Framingham, Massachusetts, which I believe is right outside of Boston. And Brian from Evanston, Illinois, which,
of course, is
right outside of Chicago. Also want to thank Eva from Syracuse, New York. And to tie in a little bit with the show this week, Syracuse, New York, and that whole sort of Finger Lakes Western New York region was at the heart of the abolitionist movement. It was at one of the centers of the Underground Railroad.
Go Professor Robinson.
There you go. Mike from Chaska, Minnesota. Chaska, Minnesota.
You have to know that.
Beautiful Minnesota River Valley. You know who else is from the beautiful Minnesota River Valley?
No.
Yours truly. Chris from Summerland Key, Florida. I am waiting to know when the Summerland Key Film Festival is.
Because
we will be there. Sam from Orleans, Massachusetts. Sam McLean from Film in Review Online. He's a great listener of the show. I always and a great supporter as well.
Yeah, had a chance to meet up with him again in Toronto at the film festival.
Benjamin from Concord, New Hampshire. We're slowly taking over the Granite State.
All the Concords or Concords need to chime in.
Right. And Julius from Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland, of course, on the banks of the mighty Cuyahoga. Burn on, Big River. Burn on. I will send out a free mug to somebody that can name what movie I'm referencing right there.
Now you're just giving stuff away, huh?
Exactly.
Randomly?
I feel so good.
You're
a giver. To understand, I mean, it's sort of ridiculous when we open our emails, or my intern opens our emails, and we see these donations from people. I mean, it really does. It helps us so much, and it puts a smile on our face, and it's sort of it really is humbling get that.
No,
people
you're
really
right.
Want to listen to us. Remember that for every $10 that you donate, your name is entered into that film spotting hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. Adam, we finally rolled out our latest edition of After Hours. We promised to get them out on a more regular basis, but our latest edition, Brief Encounter, was the review. It's available on the website if you want to go check it out. Or on iTunes, of course. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net, click on the donation tab. It's right there at the top of the page. And Adam, I do just want to mention, we did get some people actually in the last couple of weeks that wrote in and they said, hey, I'd really like to hear Film Spotting, believe it or not, on my local radio station.
Yeah.
And we get these periodically. And basically what we say is, yeah, basically what you need to do is you need to direct them to our website, send us an email. But we're also available on the Public Radio Exchange, which is PRX.org. So please, you know, if you don't have money that you'd like to donate to the show, we know that, especially in this country, the economy is pretty tight. If you want to take 5 minutes, write your local public radio affiliate or any radio station and give them our information, hey, we'll certainly play along with that. We'll take that.
Definitely. And your public radio station in town, whatever town you live in, will know about PRX.
Yes.
So again, PRX.org. You can find our shows on there. Probably the best place to send them, as you said, to get more information about possibly putting Film Spotting on their airwaves. We're on here in Chicago. We're on here in the Virginia Beach area. Of course, we would like to expand to more markets. If you can help make that possible, that would be great. And I do just want to say, as self-serving as it is, that I think that last episode of Film Spotting After Hours, if you haven't listened to it yet, was our best one by far. The Brief Encounter review I thought was interesting. I thought you were great. Had a lot of interesting points there, Maddie, about the film.
I'm always great and interesting.
No, I know that, but then you get to the end of the show, and we replayed some of the Q&A from our Film Spotting meetup. All in all, I think it's a really good listen, some great feedback on teen movies. So if you haven't checked out an After Hours yet, that's the one to go to. Again, we appreciate all the support in the show.
And I guess that I'm usually turning away when the sun rises over California skies. Well, by the time the sun sets, I'll have already laid.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and I wish you could all be here in the room to see Maddie's Rosie Perez impression there from the beginning of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. We transfer from Poster Boy, our featured artist this week, to Public Enemy, one of my favorites, believe it or not. I am a big P.E. fan, and it's, of course, one of the great opening credit sequences probably in all of cinema, and yet it's a scene that did not make our top five this week. It did not make either of our lists. We're going to get into our list of our favorite Spike Lee scenes here in a moment, but we do want to share briefly our poll questions, starting with our poll results from last week, where we asked you, which legendary actor is better these days? And we are speaking of the two actors from the new John Avnet film, Righteous Kill, which we pretty much eviscerated last week on the show. Is it Robert De Niro? Is it Al Pacino? or is it Barking Dogs? Would you actually rather watch Barking Dogs on screen?
Well, I think we actually helped with our review a little bit. I think we probably tilted this a tad.
Sure.
Bit. Robert De Niro, number one at 52%. Oh, poor Al. Mm. Poor Al Pacino. In second place at 37%, Barking Dogs.
But is there really any difference between Pacino and Barking Dogs? You really could just put those totals together.
That monologue in The Devil's Advocate, I swear to God, they put a microphone in front of a bunch of German shepherds.
They may have.
11% for Mr. Pacino.
That's
11%.
It. We did get some emails, though, in fairness to Mr. Pacino.
Exactly.
And from people who did defend
him.
And
please, this is all completely lighthearted.
Oh, yeah.
The man's a legend, and we don't mean to demean
him
at
rightfully
all.
So,
and actually,
yeah.
You know, so his performances on stage, as I said, I don't want to see De Niro's Lear. I would watch Al Pacino's Lear, and he has done. He did Roy Cohn in Angels in America. Mm-hmm. He did the Shylock in Merchant of Venice, which was filmed, which I didn't really like, but I thought he did a nice job. But also, you know, Richard III from
mm-hmm.
Looking for Richard in the mid-90s, I think is a great film.
Yeah, we really do have a ton of respect for both of those
yes.
actors, of course. Unfortunately, they keep making movies like 88 Minutes and Righteous Kill, and those aren't so good. They certainly aren't up to the caliber of the movies we want to remember from their heyday in the mid-70s. But that brings us to this week's poll question, and it does fit in perfectly here as we get into our top five this week. We want to know what your favorite Spike Lee film is, and we are excluding Do the Right Thing because I think Do the Right Thing would run away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to know what your favorite Spike Lee movie is.
Well, let me get on the poll just for a second. If you have not seen, by any chance, Do the Right Thing, you need to remedy that situation very, very
yes.
quickly. All right, well, your options are for this poll, Crooklyn, He Got Game, one of your favorites, actually.
I like it.
Inside Man, Jungle Fever, Malcolm X, She's Gotta Have It, one of his documentaries, such as When the Levees Broke,
mm-hmm.
which is great, and Other.
A lot of options.
I want to know, does Other include Do the Right Thing?
No, it does
okay.
not. Excluding Do the Right Thing. So you cannot include that in Other. And we just want to warn everyone right now, don't flood us with emails. We know there are a lot of other good Spike Lee films,
right.
and you will just have to lump those into Other. I'm sorry, we can't include 10 or 15 options in every poll question. So those were the ones we picked. Let us know which film you prefer at filmspotting.net. Maddie, which one would you go with of those choices?
Well, out of those, I think I'd have to go with Malcolm X.
Yeah,
very
me too.
Close. It'd be Crooklyn or Malcolm X.
Yeah, both good choices, but I also would go with Malcolm X. And with that, let's get into our top five Spike Lee scenes. We really do have to thank, again, Kamaria, who I referenced earlier in the show during our discussion of Miracle at St. Anna. She was the one who wrote in and said, hey, you did your top five Coen Brothers scenes. Don't you think you should honor Spike Lee with the top five Spike Lee scenes? And she was absolutely
right.
We actually probably would have been dumb enough not to give Spike his due without that email prompting us. So we do thank Kamaria for the suggestions. And like with that top five, Maddie, with the Coen Brothers, you did your top five Lebowski scenes. You said, you know, if you're going to do your top five Coen scenes, you could almost just devote them all to Lebowski. And I agree with that. Here, we found a similar thing. You really could almost devote your entire list to Do the Right Thing. We did not do that, but it's definitely going to appear on our list here, without
right.
a doubt.
So without further ado, two white guys from the Midwest give you their top five Spike Lee
Enjoy.
Scenes. Exactly. Well, my number five is from Malcolm X. And the scene that stays with me is that trademark Spike Lee people mover scene.
Yeah.
The camera directly on Denzel Washington as Malcolm. He's making his way to the Audubon Ballroom. He's completely lost in his thoughts, and he's stopped by a small old black woman. She's got this warm smile and these eyes. Out of all the great scenes in that movie, that's the one. The simplicity of that scene, Jesus will protect you, that stays with me.
Yeah, no, it's a great pick and definitely a great film. I will say there will be a Malcolm X appearance here on my list as well. My number five, though, I'm going with one that I think a lot of people would mention, at least in their top 10, and it is from Summer of Sam, the Baba O'Reilly montage. Yes, where you have Adrian Brody with the punk hair and the Fender Strat. He's rocking out to The Who. Spike is intercutting that with scenes from the film that include almost all the main characters and storylines in the film into this montage. And that's just what Lee, I think, usually is so good at and what he doesn't do so well, unfortunately, in St. Anna, but dispensing information, moving the story forward using sound and images, not relying on dialogue. He's one of the best at it, and it's on display there in the Baba O'Reilly sequence.
That's a great pick. It's one of my honorable mentions. Well, for my number four, there are a few performances that I really feel have not been given their due. Sam Jackson in Jungle Fever as Gator,
Gator
is one of those performances. And it's funny because you can measure the greatness of an actor by their bad performances. When you're watching Sam Jackson in something like Deep Blue Sea, you can only shake your head and tune out because you know that Samuel Jackson is an amazing actor. Now, when someone of lesser talent turns in, you know, sort of a bum performance like, I don't know, I guess the comic answer would be Keanu Reeves. Mm-hmm. But, you know, take someone like Greg Kinnear. And I like Greg Kinnear. But you never watch him in a bad performance and say to yourself, oh, man.
What a waste.
Well, Greg Kinnear can be so good at times. But you do. I mean, Sam Jackson really is that good. And in that film, he is amazing.
Well, what's your scene? Is there a specific Gator scene?
Gator's last dance.
Gator, what do you want?
I need to see you.
The good reverend doctor isn't here.
I know. That's why I need to see you now.
Well, hurry up. Come on. Hurry up. Hurry up.
Hey, pretty lady, remember me?
Say whatever you have to say and go before your father comes back.
Yeah, don't you like my dancing anymore? And you usually offer to cook me something to eat.
I ain't playing with you, Gator.
Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee, of course, Spike regulars. It is a great pick. And you're right, though, I do want to say, and I may be wrong, I think that was the first film he did start to get legitimate credit as an actor for, where people did recognize him. But you're right, probably has kind of been overlooked over the years. It's a great pick. My number four, another movie that I think is overlooked a little bit. I'm one of the few people that I remember, anyway, among my friends really liking it, and it is the end sequence from The 25th Hour, one of his more recent films with Ed Norton. And I did consider, of course, the very memorable scene, the confession scene, the FU scene, where Ed Norton is in the bathroom of the pub and he's talking about New Yorkers. It's great, but I got to give credit to one of our listeners who already sent in his list of Spike Lee scenes, anticipating this list, Kabir from Chicago. He says it perfectly. He says, the last scene of the film where Brian Cox narrates a life that might have never happened, a path taken for Monty, the main character. The sheer beauty of the words, of the images, of their road trip, of the new life, of the biggest if there can be. It always gets dusty in the room. It always gets me. Maybe not the best scene, but my favorite for sure. Kabir, very well written, and you're dead on. I like that scene a lot as well. I was leaning towards that mirror scene, as I said, but then I got Kabir's email, and it reminded me just how much I love the end sequence.
Oh, that's a great, great pick. All right, well, my number three comes from Crooklyn, 1994's Crooklyn. I love Spike's portrayal of the family dynamic. In every film, mm-hmm. he manages to get that in there. And in the semi-autobiographical family comedy, the scenes that stick out for me are the dinner scenes
yep.
with the brilliant Delroy Lindo and Elfrey Woodard as the parents. But my favorite scene is the movie Stealer involving the kids and the Partridge family. Let's go ahead and hear a clip. I just love that scene. It just they burst into song. To me, it's sort of transcendent. It speaks to the warmth emitted by that film.
Yeah, no, that's a great pick, and one I completely forgot about, though I did consider one of those big dinner scenes from Crooklyn, because there's like a dance going on. It's very
yep.
musical. All those voices and the sounds of the glasses and the silverware on the table, it's really good stuff. Crooklyn, actually a movie that I remember we had to watch in film school. As a grad student, we watched Crooklyn, so one of those definitely overlooked Spike Lee movies, I think. My number three is from He Got Game, and it's the Big Time Willie speech, which I cannot play here on the show, unfortunately. The actor Roger Guinevere Smith as the drug dealer, as Big Time Willie, he's in a lot of Spike Lee films, including Do the Right Thing, but he takes Ray Allen and his teammate Booger for a ride, and he tells Jesus what he is going to expect, what he's going to get out of life in the NBA. It's raw. It's in your face. It's explicit as can be. It's Spike Lee doing what he does best. Again, not pulling any punches and using the camera to a large extent. He's forcing us to see the effects of the things that Willie is talking about, the drugs and the women and the hangers-on. It's all there. It's visceral. I love that scene. It's hard to watch, but I love it.
Well, raw and explicit, you beautifully set up my number two, which is the final scene from Do the Right Thing. If you haven't seen this film, I really don't want to give it away, but imagine, we had no idea what this film, how this film was going to end. Remember, this is one of its early works. We have no idea how they are going to cap this tension mounting throughout this film. It could have been tied up really, really neatly. I mean, there was no precedent for a film like this before, because you have early on, you've got Radio Raheem giving his love in his hate speech. So maybe, of course, this young director is going to play it safe. But of course not. He doesn't do that. And he does just the opposite. He gives us a challenging, even infuriating final encounter between the characters of Mookie, played by Spike Lee, and Danny Aiello as Sal. That film, that scene is brilliant.
Yeah, and the whole film is brilliant. It's a great pick. My number two, here's where I'm throwing on Malcolm X. And maybe this is a scene that not everyone would think of, but it honestly is the first scene that pops into my mind, and I'm calling it the Honorable Elijah Muhammad betrayal scene. And yet, I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure I have all the specifics of it down. I wasn't able to pop the movie in before coming in to talk about this, so I don't know everything that happens in the scene. It's been so long since I've seen it, but it's the scene that had the biggest impact on me when I saw it originally. It's when Malcolm hears that Elijah Muhammad is betraying his teachings by, I believe, sleeping with other women. And he has a meeting with him at his palatial estate, and he confronts him about it. And he knows Elijah Muhammad's lying to him. And this is that tipping point in their fractured relationship.
Exactly.
What do you do when the man who has been your role model, who made you everything you are, who you believe everything he says,
when you pull the curtain back,
and he proves to be a hypocrite. How do you react to that? That disillusionment and that sense of betrayal is crushing for Malcolm X. It was crushing for me as a viewer watching it.
Oh, that's a great pick. All right. Well, my number one, again, from Do the Right Thing, and that is the racial rant scene. There are so many wonderful scenes in this film to choose from. There's the sneaker scene with Giancarlo Esposito, Radio Raheem buying batteries for his ghetto blaster from the Korean grocery store. The great Ossie Davis, again, as the mayor. But my favorite is this direct address to the camera from several of the film's characters. They are just spewing racial epithets. It's powerful to watch to this day. Honestly, I have to say, Do the Right Thing has to be inching its way closer to our pantheon.
It should be in there.
If it's not there yet, I think we just need to put it up
there. We maybe just need to put it there, because it actually has come up on quite a few top fives over the past 200-plus shows, and it does belong there. It's a great pick. In fact, it's my number one, and you stole my thunder a little bit, Maddie. You did reference it. Let's go ahead and hear Radio Raheem with another direct address to the camera with the story of love and hate.
Let me tell you the story of right hand, left hand. It's a tale of good and evil. Hate. It was with this hand that Cain iced his brother. Love. These five fingers, they go straight to the soul of man. The right hand, the hand of love. The story of life is this. Static.
What I love about it is it's just one take. The camera starts on him and Mookie, and then it just rolls over and shows just Radio Raheem talking to the camera. When he's all done with his speech, the camera pivots again. We see Mookie back in the shot. It's just this great little diversion. It's very theatrical, like a lot of Spike Lee's movies are. He has a lot of those diversions in it, and it's just fantastic to watch. You got Fight the Power playing on the boombox underneath it, and that story of love and hate, that's Spike Lee in a nutshell. I think you said it very well. If you want to kind of sum it up very simply, that's how you do it. It's an amazing scene, and you're right. There's so many from that movie. When you talk about my honorable mentions, the opening Fight the Power scene that we played at the start of the segment, when Pino and Mookie have a talk, where Mookie talks to him about, you appreciate all these black people. Right. You like Magic Johnson. That scene
and,
I love.
And that's the lead into my rant scene.
Yeah.
That's the prelude to that.
Exactly. It's a good one. There are so many. I also really do love, you mentioned Giancarlo Esposito, but I think from that sneaker scene, I always think of John Savage and, of course, the Larry Bird jersey that he's wearing. Those scenes are all great. What about you with some honorable mentions?
Well, I have the Harvey Keitel interrogation scene in Clockers and the Step Show performance in School Days. I do really like that film.
Okay, and I touched on a few of them, the confession scene from The 25th Hour, in addition to those great scenes from Do the Right Thing. And there are several scenes from Jungle Fever, including many of them with Gator, that I did consider for this list. And I will admit, there are a few Spike Lee movies I haven't seen. Girl 6, I haven't seen Clockers, I haven't seen She Hate Me, was that what that was called?
Yeah,
one of his
I think
recent
so.
Ones.
I didn't see it. It
was Anthony Mackie maybe in that, who's an actor I like, but I didn't see the movie, but that really was a fun list, actually, to put together. I'm afraid that my list was maybe a little bit too generic. I really do look forward to seeing what the listeners have to say.
All right. Well, those are our top five Spike Lee scenes. Send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
out new in wide release this weekend, the new Spike Lee film Miracle at St. Anna. Eagle Eye is opening with Shia LaBeouf, and Fireproof, which I have to confess I know absolutely nothing about. Also in wide release, Knights of Rodanthe. This is Richard Gere and Diane Lane reuniting from their wonderful steamy or not so steamy love affair in Unfaithful. Out in limited release, Alan Ball's Towelhead. This is a movie that played Maddie either at Toronto or at the last Sundance. I can't remember. I remember most critics not liking it all that much.
It's getting very mixed reviews.
It is getting very mixed reviews. One of those films that really kind of infuriates you, though. It's really going to get a reaction out of you, from what I hear. That's out in limited release, as well as Choke, the new movie with Sam Rockwell. I know many of our listeners are looking forward to that film. And next week on the show, we may fit in some thoughts on Choke, a movie I saw most of at the last Sundance but had to leave, unfortunately. We're also going to talk about the new Bill Maher documentary, Religulous, and Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. Tying in with that, we're going to do our top five movie soundtracks, a redux list of a long ago episode of the show where we did that. But Maddie, I look forward to hearing your choices on that top five.
All right. Well, thanks as always to Candace for her invaluable assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Steve Edwards at Chicago Public Radio, along with Golden Joe Dassault for his great production help. Music this week was provided by Poster Boy. Learn more at posterboyrock.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
For original coverage of this year's film festivals, check out blog.spout.com. Then discover more about the movies and join the conversation yourself at spout.com.
Stop it, Rosie Perez. Can you do a Rosie Perez, Maddie? Give us a little.
No, I can't.
No, you can't. That was more Leguizamo than Rosie Perez.
Oh, God. I am a diverse
you
corporation.
Are. Yes, you are.
I see color, but I don't mind.
No.
That's the thing. Mm-hmm. That's what I hate about Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and people like that. That Stephen Colbert absolutely, completely gets right when he ridicules them. Oh, we don't see color.
Sure.
Oh, there's no color. Fuck you. Yes, there is color in this world. The fact of the matter is, you just shouldn't care.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.